Hey everyone, Michael with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Appreciate you being here. Today on the show, we've got Darren Epstein. He is our first repeat guest. I am so happy that I had the chance to speak with him again. We got to do it another time in the future because there's so much to talk about. He's a former DOD guy, so he's seen it all. There's a lot of strong opinions about how Bitcoin could win and that we could move to a Bitcoin standard, and yet we might not have the freedom and self-sovereignty that many envision if we do it the wrong way. I think you're going to love this episode. Enjoy listening to Darren's thoughts on a wide range of topics. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Darren here. Darren, welcome back to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks for having me again. It's my pleasure to be here.
My first repeat guest. I'm looking forward to this. I had so many people messaging me and telling me how much they loved our first conversation. So that's not pressure. Hey, we got a lot of topics to cover. So for everyone listening, Darren sent me several slides, lots of bullet points, things that we can cover, things that have changed in the world since we last chatted. I want to start with the first bullet point that you mentioned, and you just said, let's talk about a Bitcoin standard versus a government Bitcoin standard. And you seem to distinguish the two. I suspect I know where you might be going based on what I know about you, but I'd love for you to explain the distinction and maybe elaborate on your thoughts.
Yeah. So to be clear, it's a Bitcoin standard, right? The free market adopting a Bitcoin standard rather than governments adopting a strategic Bitcoin reserve. So, and I know other guests of yours have pulled at this, and I know you've discussed it on Bitcoin Banter as well. And so I'm into Bitcoin. I'm a Bitcoiner. And like I've told you before, I came at as an investor. I'm 60 years old, and I just looked at, I'm class of 2020, just like Michael Saylor. And I looked at what is available in the environment. And the environment at the time in 2020, was we were getting into March of 2020, we hit the stock market dip that was the anticipation of what was going to happen with the COVID shutdown. So a lot of me and my colleagues were looking at sounder assets, and we were gold bugs at the time. Fortunately, we got out of the market at the right time because we were watching global macro develop. And that's when I got into Bitcoin. I read the Bitcoin standard in 2019. And decided to approach it as an investor. Very quickly, as I went down the road, like Michael Saylor talks about doing the, because you can't just dip your toe. You can either dip your toe, and I know you've discussed it before. You dip your toe, you're in shitcoin world pretty quickly. And because I'm older, I didn't really have time. The shitcoin aspect of certain, and for me, it only took effect through Ethereum. Because everybody was talking about blockchain at the time. And so I decided that it would be interesting at least to put some of my resources in this asset. And I looked at it as an asset that has all the characteristics that we know of Bitcoin. And that, no one put a gun to my head to make that happen. No government agency said, hey, you're going to put 20% of your assets into Bitcoin. I came to it by myself. I discussed it with colleagues. I started listening to podcasts. Saifedean Ammous was the guy who really kind of inculcated my mind into believing into this asset. I read the Bitcoin standard, the gold standard, when he had Principles of Economics. I've gone down that road. So I've always adopted this idea that for me to have Bitcoin, to be able to use it as a peer-to-peer cashless system, that would be a store of value, a unit of account, a means of exchange, that it, and I came at it as a libertarian, that it just required human action. It required me and you and others in the network to develop the network effect for us to be able to understand that we're going to use this for money. And that money is going to be superior to something that's also produced by computers, but on a whim, but at somebody at the Federal Reserve, putting in digits on a keyboard. There's no proof of work. So understanding how Bitcoin works and that it can build out in the free market, peer-to-peer, person to person. I don't care if private corporations adopt it like MicroStrategy. And we have yet to see where that's going to lead. But then to make a leap from, and that would be a Bitcoin standard, right? As fiat, the value of fiat, we've seen what it's done since the introduction of the Federal Reserve Act, 1913, the purchasing power, right? It's not that the value of Bitcoin is going up vis-a-vis other currencies. It's that other currencies' purchasing power is going down. Ergo, Bitcoin's purchasing power is going up. And so if you believe in that, you believe you hold a superior asset, in the free market, you're going to be fine. But if then you make this leap and say that governments, which created this problem of just printing fiat and all the things that we complain about, right? There's the fiat food book. Saifedean talks about fiat architecture. We look at the fiat healthcare system. We look at the military industrial complex, right? We look at the billions of dollars that the US government and through its empire doles out to countries around the world when the United States is suffering economically. I don't have the trust, not only in a government, but especially the government of the United States, which is a government that manages a global empire with 800 bases around the world. When the United States financially sneezes, the world gets a cold. I don't trust that entity with a strategic Bitcoin reserve. Because what's the end state of that? Now, Michael Saylor has said, and people can write in the comments and correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding, he used the term manifest destiny. So Michael Saylor talked about how empires, but specifically the United States, build out its imperial realm. He talks about empires now having air power, sea power, and he talks about having this power in the digital space, which is going to help the United States maintain its hegemony, its global hegemony around the world. I question, is that a good thing? When the United States is $36 trillion in debt, and that's climbing, $200-something trillion in unfunded liabilities, Senator Loomis is putting forth legislation to get the to adopt a Bitcoin strategic reserve. And the only reason that I can really understand that they're advocating that is because our debt is so big that this one move will help reduce the debt. But I haven't seen any public politician talk about cutting spending on anything, let alone the military industrial complex, right, which is gets $1 trillion a year when you include the intelligence agencies. Like I said, has 800 bases around the world, and they can't pass an audit. And they haven't been able to pass an audit. So now what you're going to do is take the world's best asset, the soundest money ever, and somehow, and you know, I know you guys also did a show, I think it was Bitcoin Banter, when you talked about how the Fed can't buy Bitcoin. So how the federal government is going to work out how it's going to purchase it, whether it's going to print money to buy it, whether it's going to sell assets, and then who owns the assets? Is it we the people? Is it the government? When did we the people turn the assets over to the government to control? And we're somehow going to expect that this government that can't manage the borders, right, that oversaw the COVID lockdowns, that has a broken healthcare system, that has this military industrial complex that we talked about, where government agencies like FEMA are shown to be hollow shells when people in the United States are relying on them for some sort of assistance after a disaster. There is complete distrust in Congress, like I've mentioned before, the trillions of dollars or billions of dollars per year that are given in foreign aid, in military aid to whom they choose, based on the donor class giving them money, right? And so how does somebody like Nancy Pelosi enter office with you know, humble means? I shouldn't say humble means, because her husband was a successful businessman. They had a restaurant chain, I believe, out in San Francisco. But that parlays her position into hundreds of millions of dollars, right? How do all these politicians leave wealthy? And this is the system that we're going to somehow turn over trust in to manage a strategic Bitcoin reserve. To do what? That's what I'm asking. To do what? To pay down the debt? Because let me tell you, if these guys adopt this Bitcoin strategic reserve, let's do a hypothetical, and the debt gets cut in half tomorrow, they're going to start spending like drunken sailors, right? And so whenever I get into these debates on, and it's not really debates, these interactions on X regarding this phenomenon, I always get some sort of lesson. Well, Bitcoin's different because it's run on a node and it's going to be self-custodied and all the, you know, it's immutable. So the government can't do X, Y, Z. Okay. The government has the guns. The government has the tanks. The government has the exclusive use of the monopoly on violence. So just like what Michelle Weakley talked about when on the show that she was on, there is a gauntlet of regulation that the government is going to put in your way, no matter how you manage yourself through the Bitcoin space. They will guard on-ramps and off-ramps. They will put onerous legislation on Bitcoiners so that it becomes very difficult to operate even in the free market or to open up a software wallet like she went through. You have to have money and teams of lawyers just to manage this regulation. I don't trust, and even though we can discuss in more depth when the Trump administration comes in, which we are all hoping is a more friendly regulatory environment, and that's why many of us supported him based on maybe this issue and maybe a few others. Certainly could not be more unfriendly than the Biden administration. But at the end of the day, we're not talking about administration-specific issues, because these issues, Trump's got 4 years. And regardless of who follows him, whether it's J.D. Vance or whoever, we just don't know enough about the macro environment to entrust one sat worth of Bitcoin to large governments. Is that true of all governments? Perhaps not. That might work for a small government that doesn't manage an empire like El Salvador. But then again, I still defer to, I would much rather see a Bitcoin standard develop and then the role of government be substantially reduced. That's because I ultimately believe in much smaller government entities. And we can talk about later. I believe in, you know, the founders, many of the founders believed in seceding from Great Britain. That's what they did when they wrote the Declaration of Independence. There may be an opportunity for certain polities, say Florida, right? I believe pension funds in Florida are adopting. And I think you discussed with Matteo Pellegrini, Wisconsin adopting it. But the counter to that is, how big is that economy? Not very big. Florida's economy is bigger than many European countries. So you may see an experiment such as that, where you have large states like Florida and Texas, where their pension funds might invest in Bitcoin a la MicroStrategy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it really comes down to what are your expectations of government? And if your expectations of government are that we should have more bigger government underwritten by the best money ever invented, I don't support that, because I believe in a more limited role of government. And for me, if the fiat standard ends up being something that's not manageable anymore, and that causes the demise of government, I'm okay with that. I would much prefer if we as Bitcoiners can look out into the future, anticipate that, and gradually switch over to a Bitcoin standard, which is something that the Bitcoin way advocates anyway. So that's not any surprise to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so for anyone listening, I guess I just need to say this. My thinking, I think, on this topic of the strategic reserve in particular, but many tangential topics as well, has evolved a lot. So things I've said in the past, you know, I could completely contradict as we talk, because I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. Like, I think like as recently as Nashville, when, you know, Trump spoke at the Bitcoin conference, I was there, and I mean, I still would say it was cool being there. And if that turns into a historic moment, you know, I got to be a part of history at the time, though, just, you know, what's 5 or 6 months ago or whatever. I was optimistic about it. And as I've talked, especially with guys like Rick and Tony and the team and people who are, you know, responsibly more skeptic of, you know, these, all the things that, that could mean, I think I've become less enthralled at the idea, because I would rather people front run government. Where I think maybe not take issue with what you said, but push back is, don't you think it's always been inevitable though, that at some point, you know, governments, nation states would adopt Bitcoin somehow, whether as legal tender, like El Salvador has done, although it seems like they have maybe backpedaled for a loan from
the IMF.
Yeah. Or like as a strategic reserve asset, like we're talking about here. And those are, as I understand it, to be two different things. I mean, from your perspective, was this always inevitable that this would be a conversation that we're having? And your hope is just, yes, even though they're going to want to do this at some point in time, they're going to want to get on the Bitcoin bandwagon, we need to front run them as best we can in the free market. People like yourself and myself just choosing to operate on a Bitcoin standard.
Yeah, that's well said, Michael. And I think that is, when I think of some of the conversations that you and Tony have had on Bitcoin Banter, the group of you, listening to you, I'm with you, Michael. You know, I'm teasing this out as we go. I could very easily look back at this podcast and say, well, prove me wrong. But my problem is, and this is one of the things that I kind of get into on X sometimes, where I'm mostly political, is my affectation, my hobby has been history, and particularly military history. So, like we talked about off air before I came on, you can drive yourself crazy with this stuff. I'm not saying that I expect to live in a perfect society, but these problem sets really come down to the freedom aspect. And I don't know, it may have been Matteo, but I've heard discussed before this fault line that we can see developing in this Bitcoin space. And that's on one side is it's freedom money. It's, you know, the white paper or die. I will self-custody and run a note. And I do believe in all of that. It's like, say, you know, you can't say that you're going to have anything of value and just not lock your front door. There are just certain things that you have to do. Governments have always sought to extract resources from the citizenry, always. And I was listening to something recently about how the, you know, there's, of course, there's a classic fall of the Roman Empire. When the government becomes too parasitic on the citizenry, then there are political fault lines that that start to separate. And that's where you get revolution, secession, chaos. And I'm not implying that if you don't have government, you have chaos. I believe in the opposite. I think government provides most of the problem. So that the fault line that we're on right now, Bitcoin, is it this freedom money that everyone desires, peer-to-peer cashless digital money monetary system? Or is it a store of value where if you have enough of it at a certain time and you secure it, that you and your progeny will be better off in the future for understanding. Now, if fiat weren't collapsing at the same time, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And I don't even know if it's necessary that you would have to be on the gold standard, but say we were on a gold standard and say our government didn't go through the progressive era. Say our government didn't decide at some point, let's use 1898, the Spanish-American War, that it was going to be an overseas empire, the Great White Fleet, Teddy Roosevelt, 1913, Federal Reserve Act, 1914, World War One. We send troops to Europe. We have somewhat of an interregnum between the world wars, and then the United States enters World War II and then takes over Pax Britannica which becomes Pax Americana, the new American world order based on the petrodollar that we're working in right now. And then the only counterbalance to that is really a somewhat imperial Soviet Union, which is mostly a landmass. But at the end, it was so broken because of its own corruption that it just couldn't compete with the financial prowess of the West. So we are at a point now, right, in this moment in history where the United States is the sole superpower and may dictate whether or not I believe, because look, a lot of the center of gravity in the United States, Bitcoin is in the United States. So the U.S. government may be the arbiters that are deciding the answer to this question. Is it digital freedom money, right? Are they going to just let us do what we want with it? We're just going to go ahead and store, and they're not going to tax it. We already know what there's new tax regulations coming in next year. Or is it going to be this store of value that, you know, if you then buy MicroStrategy and you see what Michael Saylor's doing, and you know, there's a debate on whether that's going to work out or not, and the value of that goes up. And I believe you talked about it with Matteo. Michael Saylor isn't on the freedom money side. He said it during that famous interview where he said, if you're some person that is just a hodler sitting around running a node, that's not what I'm talking about. That's not going to get you. And you can tell that he may have believed that at one point, but he's transitioning to being, and I'm going to use the term oligarch, right? Because I just think it's natural human nature. And you can tell he went from the point of where he was willing to talk to anybody at any time and have great patience with explaining Bitcoin. Now that, you know, there's that famous video of him going, you know, sighing all the time, having to explain. Now he's at the point where, and I've worked with these people before because I spent so much time in the military. He's like a general officer, like a 4-star. These guys were idiots when they were lieutenant colonels. They kissed ass. They made their way through the system. And then they just became these brilliant guys. I'm not accusing Michael Saylor of doing that, but he was the manager of the CEO of a zombie corporation, made a great move. I'm not taking anything away from him. Made a brilliant move because I believe in that strategy. I invest in MicroStrategy, money that is tied up in an IRA, and he's done well for his shareholders. Good on him. But then don't expect that he is going to champion anything that doesn't make his stock go up. And hence, it's tied to Bitcoin, and it may influence the price of Bitcoin. But hence, he's on board with Larry Fink and the ETFs. Was that inevitable? Yes, that's inevitable. You talked about it with other guests. We understand that there is going to be this build out and this adoption, but I think we're at that fault line right now. And look, deep down inside, it's like when you know it's like when you're driving off to college and you have half a tank of gas. You know, there's a voice that says, hey, go fill up the tank. And then you don't. And you're like, I'll be good. I've made it on half a tank lots of times. And then you're driving and there's an accident on the highway and you're stuck in a traffic jam. And all you can see is that needle on E. I kind of get that feeling that the freedom money aspect could be dying before us. And that it's going to be one of these things where I don't know how many people, 100 million folks own some Bitcoin, or if you're in the fiat US dollar based system and you make your money in US dollars and you're able to transfer that to an exchange and buy Bitcoin or however you get your Bitcoin, and you're able to hold that in self-custody, I believe that is an asset that over time is going to make people more wealthy than if they did not do that. But I wouldn't extrapolate from that. Again, when we bring up several times that fix the money, fix the world, I wouldn't extrapolate that from that. So it's not going to be a solution for the vast majority of people on the planet. It could be if it was freedom money, but I have a feeling with all of it being gobbled up by ETFs and corporations and like you suggested before, I think a lot of us have been front running these things, and if you front run it, you're going to be okay. And look, if you're stacking today, if you're dollar cost averaging and you're stacking $10 a week or whatever, I'm not saying that I don't think it's going to go up in value as corporations adopt it, as governments adopt it. It's just not, you know, like Michelle Weekly said, what do I value more than Bitcoin? I value freedom. I value liberty. And I don't conflate Bitcoin with freedom or liberty anymore. I think the potential is there, but there's a lot of things that human beings have to decide that they're going to do. And one of those things is asking the question, what is their relationship with government? And should government get more power than it does now to do things that people don't think about, right? When people are, there are more people in the United States that can tell you the schedule of the college football playoff this year and go more into depth into that than can point out Ukraine on a map.
Yeah. So maybe one of my questions for you was, you said that fixing the money, we could end up in a place where we fix the money, so to speak, and we still have violent empires. Like, that's an entirely possible scenario in which we find ourselves. So I guess the, cause in my mind, the one potential value of governments adopting Bitcoin, like even a government Bitcoin standard, so to speak, is its scarcity and proof of work mechanism could fundamentally rein in much of the violence. But what we're talking about with like a strategic reserve is not a dollar backed or a Bitcoin backed dollar, rather. It's potentially a massive stockpile of the most valuable asset or form of money on the planet in Bitcoin, plus the ability to still print dollars ad nauseum and do whatever the hell they want to do. I think that maybe that's a way of thinking about what you're describing here. Like, yes, okay, we have Bitcoin and we have global adoption on some broad level because the US adopted a strategic reserve, but they didn't rein in their spending. They didn't rein in, you know, the handouts. They didn't rein in their, you know, military intervention, you know, across the world. Is that kind of what you like, why you envision you could quote unquote fix the money, but you're not really fixing the world the way that many people assume Bitcoin would?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. And, you know, I first of all, it's going to take a while for the dollar to die out. The other concern that I have is, and I don't, maybe there's a sleight of hand that's by design, but I think this whole discussion about a CBDC kind of looms in the background of all of this. And that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of the people who are, let's use Trump, for example, because he doesn't know anything about Bitcoin. You know, like you said, they whisper
was that
in his
obvious?
Ear and then he, right. And that's okay. That's okay. And he's also said that he wants the dollar to remain the global reserve currency. And so when people, I don't really understand this excitement and worry over CBDC, because the way I see it, I think we talked about this before, we have a CBDC. Right. When's the last time that you went, when I was in the Army, when I was probably a private first class, I at Fort Benning, Georgia, I went to a pay window and they gave me dollars. So still, if you think about it, I'm working for them and they're giving me paper. And so I got the paper, which is fine. It's fine because other people have been duped into believing that this paper has value. But, and I remember what a big thing it was. It was sometime in the 90s where you would just get automatic deposit into your bank account. And I didn't even know how that worked, because, you know, when I was a battery commander, a captain in Korea in 1995, I didn't have a computer on my desk. So a lot of this stuff existed before really the adoption of computers. And when I was in, that was in 1996, when I was in command, one of my non-commissioned officers played around with computers, and he made like this internal LAN. And he's like, sir, well, these computers can talk to each other. I was like, how is that possible? And so I'm sorry, I lost track. What were we talking about?
We were talking about fix the money. Like even if we were to fix the money,
yeah,
we could still end up with violent empires. Was sort of the gist of it. Yeah.
So, you know, you adopt this new currency that is like, I guess it's tied to my last story, on, you know, starting to understand this technology, starting to adopt the technology, starting to use the technology. Nobody forced me to do that. But then the technology gets perverted. And so you go from that moment where I've got an internal LAN, I'm now getting my paycheck automatically deposited into my account. I didn't understand how that worked then. And it's taken me years to understand that this is where we are now with the Federal Reserve. Somebody inputting data on a computer, and that data at some point goes to the Department of Defense. I'm on somebody's roster in the Department of Defense in some sort of finance system, and somebody puts in my Social Security number or some sort of keystrokes, and every month, every 2 weeks, digits arrive in my pay system. Now, I don't know how people mainly did it in the private sector. I got checks when I was younger. But in the Department of Defense, we've been using a CBDC for as long as I can remember. And so I don't know why people are incredulous as to why the government can't or DOD can't pass an audit, because it's just at the levels of people putting in inputs, and then it just spits out these digits to all of the troops. And that's how bills get paid with through the defense, finance, and accounting system everywhere. So when Congress sends $14 billion to Ukraine for what? They tell DOD to credit or to use their account to send digits somewhere to Lockheed Martin or wherever. And then these platforms get delivered. So this entire system is built with a CBDC already on it. I believe if you now are able to tell the American people, and I don't understand how you're going to convince folks. You, of course, you know, time chain, blockchain. We're going to be able to see that the Bitcoin ended up somewhere in that's managed by someone in the government. Are they managing nodes? Are they managing what are they doing? Or is the government going to keep it on an exchange? And are we going to trust whatever and we can see that if you run a node, we can see where all this stuff ended up. And then is the government then going to decide they're going to maintain this reserve because they know it's going to go up in value, or really the purchasing power of the dollar is going down, and that this was a really good investment for the government. And at some point they're officially going to announce, well, we're just going to tokenize this thing. And then this is going to become, it's like having a gold standard, and we're going to issue these coins or whatever that's based off of this reserve, this gold reserve that we have in Fort Knox, Kentucky. Right now, now we're able to convince the Americans that we've got how many, like a million Bitcoin, and that we're able to issue tokens off of this. And because we believe that Bitcoin at the time will become adopted globally, that the value will go up, that we'll all be better off. I just have a hard time. I understand what's written in the legislation and the promise of it. But the two problems I have is, and I just delved into the realm of pure speculation, right? But all I know is I don't trust anyone in government to manage any portion of that, right? And that's why I'm scared. I don't think you can be a Bitcoin maxi or somebody who takes time to be on a podcast discussing Bitcoin and not be extremely paranoid about information systems, like Tony talks about all the time, right? He's more paranoid than any of us because he started on the dark side. I was just listening to the latest episode you guys dropped. So he knows. And we know what steps we have to take in order to secure it and then to manage it. There's different pieces of it, right? It's not only securing it, it's really managing. What do you do with it? Are you spending it? Are you running a node? And how are you going to leave that to your kids and the functionality of it? All those things that you guys help with at the Bitcoin Way. And then to make the leap of faith that somehow someone in the government is going to manage all of that on behalf of who? The American people. And again, I ask the fundamental question is to do what? Is to increase the financial power of the United States? That's what Michael Saylor would pitch, that the United States as an look, there's a whole group of people out there, and Scott Horton writes about this and talks about it. The you know, guy who runs antiwar.com and Libertarian Institute just wrote a book called Provoked, where he kind of goes through what made how did the United States provoke Russia into going into Ukraine. Not going to go down that rabbit hole. But there are legions of people, and this is in my realm. I know because I spent 36 years in DOD and I worked with State Department folks. I work with high level folks in DC, in foreign countries, and they all believe in American hegemony, in American power, in doing whatever they can to make that a reality. And so at the end of the day, it's not only the management piece of it that has me concerned, because I don't trust government. Everything government touches goes to crap. So that's on the management of it, I don't trust. And the second part is, why would I want an all-consuming panopticon federal government that spies on all of us, right? That regulates the bank. And you've talked about it with several guests, that regulates the banking system, that is going to try to regulate the crap out of what we do with Bitcoin. Why would we want that type of entity or any government to have large stockpiles of Bitcoin? I'm just very skeptical about it.
Well, I think I probably have a good answer for you, and it's something I've talked about with we've probably talked about it on Bitcoin Banter too. And to be fair, I'm class of 2022. Like, I'm still early on my journey, but I think I don't have, this isn't a pat on my back or anything like that, but I think I've grown to sort of philosophically align more with like some of the early cypherpunks on a lot of these things. And or at least I'm certainly trending that direction. I think as we've moved from, you know, the innovators into the early adopters, and now we're sort of leaving that stage for the early majority, it feels like, or we're beginning to get there. It's a much less principled group of people that have a voice in Bitcoin, and it's number go up. Like, that's your answer. I think is it's like my bags are going to be pumped if we adopt a strategic reserve, if the dollar becomes backed by Bitcoin, if international trade is all settled in Bitcoin. I agree with you. I'd like all of that to happen via free market mechanism, not, well, we have to, you know, the US or fill in the blank country has to be the most powerful. And like, I'm a patriotic guy. I appreciate the ideals, you know, many of the founding fathers, what I think they were aiming for, and certainly their willingness to put their lives on the line and, you know, and sign their name on a document for something they believed in. But I think we've sort of abandoned many of those first principle notions the further we get into Bitcoin. You hear a lot less from like the cypherpunks nowadays than you do, you know, the people who are just documenting ETF flows, inflows. And like, we talk about that stuff on Bitcoin Banner, but like, our point is always, that's not Bitcoin. Like, that's paper Bitcoin. You're earning more dollars when you do that. And yes, you're using Bitcoin as a mechanism to do that, but it's not the same thing as freedom money, to your point. So, I think number go up is an important attribute of Bitcoin, because, you know, you, to achieve financial self-sovereignty, you need purchasing power. Like, I'm not an idiot. I get that. But I think we have really taken for granted all of the rest of the promise of Bitcoin, you know, the censorship resistance, you know, like no one talks about, like, you know, it's peer to peer. Like, you don't hear people talking about peer to peer technology anymore. You know, it's like, that's the beauty of it. Like, that is the promise of Bitcoin. And, yeah, it's sad because it's happened slowly enough that it takes conversations like this and talking to Tony and Rick and the guys that for me to like, remember, you know, like I have to be reminded of the promise of Bitcoin, that it's so much bigger than generational wealth, you know, which is, you know, awesome and great. But, it's not the whole ball game, I guess. There wasn't a question there. You're welcome to comment on that.
And this is, I think, what happened on the last podcast that we were on, is that I think we're so simpatico in the way we're looking at it. And we're just kind of looking at this object, and you might see a little piece of it over here, and I might see a little piece of it over there. And I think the other thing is, Michael, that, and I know, you know, you had a caveat in there, you know, you're an American, you're patriotic, all those things. The older I get, the more I dump the caveats, but they're still there. And so I'll use one now, just because we're observing the world the way that we are, and we're thinking about it and discussing it freely the way we are, doesn't mean that this is what we prefer. So I would love it if we lived in a world where I could say, yeah, I have no problem with the United States government adopting a strategic Bitcoin reserve. You know why? Because we don't have 800 bases around the world, and we didn't bomb Vietnam for 10 years, and we didn't interfere in Korea, right? And we didn't interfere in World War I and World War II, and people can get political and they have their own opinions about these. I've just spent my life reading everything I can about every conflict that the United States has been a part of. And that's one of the sad things I think I saw on X, is that for it to sink into Americans that they're not the good guys. Yeah, and not only are they not the good guys, is that, and I'm not saying Americans are bad people, right? They ignore that we are so comfortable. We love comfort so much. We've become so spoiled. I understand there are people out there that are suffering, and I have more empathy for them than anyone. And that's why I am anti-government. And I don't make the mistake of saying, and Thomas Massey, I think, did it today about, he had, a lot of these guys have several tweets, and I like Thomas Massey. But they'll say things like, this is how much money that Congress has spent on hush money for cases that they've been right. There was
sexual,
that whole thing,
sexual allegations yeah.
Right? And or this is how much money government spends on this when we could have. I'm conflating a different tweet. One was that 4,000 employees of the Department of Education make over $100,000 each, and that's money that could go to teachers. And I always have to write back saying that money doesn't exist. So don't tell me that printed money that is misallocated to this federal bureaucracy behemoth could have been printed and sent to school teachers throughout the United States. And we can get into this whole debate over, again, has our fiat public education system performed well? And that, and I know this is a different, because all these things are interconnected. Right. Yeah. There's this big dust up where Elon is promoting what Vivek has said about the immigrant visas, and Trump's all over this thing like, we need to bring more talent into the United States to do certain things. But no one's talking about how our education system has so thoroughly failed that Americans can not only have the capacity to conduct the work within the society, which is required to build out a future society that hopefully is built on a Bitcoin standard. But they've been so propagandized in these education mills that they don't have the capacity to understand that their country is one of the most hated countries in the world, because it goes around with impunity supplying weapons to other countries that kill people, and that's going on right now, or it provides intelligence support, or it's droning people, or conducting military operations where people are being killed anyway. And we have thousands of troops in Syria now. And so although sometimes these discussions in the Bitcoin world are regarded as asides, to me, I get frustrated. And it's a lot like, I think, where Matteo Pellegrini was going, in that there are a lot of other ancillary areas that we think might be on the side of the Bitcoin discussion, but they're right at the center of the Bitcoin discussion. And that's why, like I said, you can fix the money and then have a population that is still disinterested or completely unaware of any of the things that I speak about now. And one of the reasons why I've become so passionate, and then again, you know, when people can say, well, you're not patriotic or any of that stuff. Like I said, spent 22 years in the Army. I volunteered to go wherever, you know, anytime an assignment came up, I volunteered. I've been downrange. I've done it all. I teared up at the you know, playing of the national anthem. I salute the flag. But a lot of that is based on me not knowing what I should have known. And my eyes got open through these experiences where I just asked basic questions. And not only that, when I came, I spent 3 years in Europe, 6 months in the Middle East, 5 years in Korea, 7 years active duty in Japan, and then 14 years as a civilian in Japan. And then you go back to the United States and you realize that the vast majority of people don't even know that we have troops out there, right? That we have folks. What am I doing in, I'm from, you know, North Shore of Boston, Massachusetts. What am I doing in the Middle East as like a cog in the system? I was fighting for oil, because the big meme back then, before we had memes, was no blood for oil. And my position, I would write back letters to my friends. They would protest, no blood for oil. I would write, no, we need oil. I'm here to fight for oil. I'm fine with that, because I drive a car and I use oil. And then being in Korea up by the DMZ, thinking, okay, my mission is to stop the North Korean hordes from invading South Korea. Why is that? Right. And at the same time, a lot of South Koreans are protesting you being there. And I don't blame them, because we're driving around in training areas. South Korea is a built up society now. And we're driving around in training areas, tearing up farmland. And the farmers would come out and they'd be bitching and, you know, moaning at us. And my attitude was like, get out of my way. I'm, you know, my vehicles, the, you know, when every time we rev the engine, that's the sound of freedom. That's where I came from. And so I understand the geopolitics of all of it. And then I went to grad school, right, to study China. So, and I ended up being an Asia, you know, expert. But then you start to question, what is this that you're doing, maintaining this empire, guaranteeing everybody's freedom? And then you go back to the United States, and I don't enjoy going back to the U.S. a lot of times, depending on which city I go through. Right, I live in Tokyo. It's a beautiful city. It's clean. People don't leave needles and shit all over the place. We talked, you and I talked about this last time. It's a high trust society. You leave something on a train, right? You're going to get it back, right? When you go to the lost and found in 15 minutes in central Tokyo, somebody will have turned it in. That's a high trust society. Japan has its faults, but it's clean. The airports are clean. The people go out of their way to help you. When I travel through the United States, that's, you know, not necessarily the experience. Of course, they're great. The smaller the town I travel to in the United States, meeting up with real people, that still exists, and God love them. You know, when you go to a bigger city where you can see where the failures are, and that's where I understand people conflating, hey, why are we spending all this stuff on money on military when our cities are like, I understand that sentiment, but the real lesson is the money doesn't exist. And we shouldn't be spending it on overseas adventures. And it's up to the individual states to develop infrastructure. And for God's sakes, like we talked about before, if you want engineers, build them at home. But you got to do that through an educational system that isn't total crap. I know that was a bit of an aside, but you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of good thoughts. I'm not exactly sure where to start. I mean, the observation I make, you know, in hearing you talk is I think more people need to ask, what is the ROI on government, right? Like in almost anything, exactly, because we are $36 trillion in debt in the United States. The tax receipts are what, 4 or 5 trillion a year, you know, depending on the economy. And we still do have potholes. Our education system is demonstrably failing. Since the Department of Education was, you know, created in the 60s or 70s, whenever it was, we were like first in the world in education, and we're, you know, I don't know, 25th now. And like, there's, given the economic resources that we do have, and like the diverse talent pool that we could pull from, that makes no sense. It makes no sense. And most people are, to your point, just too comfortable. Because, you know, as long as you're in the top 50% and you've got maybe some assets that are, you know, helping you squeak out, you know, past inflation or whatever, you don't really think about it from an ROI perspective. And if you're in the bottom 50% and you're really struggling, and I use 50%, you know, just as an example, I don't know what number it takes to start, you know, really struggling. Most people, and it's not just because you're in the bottom 50%. Most people throughout our society have made no connection between the existence of the Federal Reserve, the actions of Congress, the actions of, you know, the executive branch in many cases, and probably the judicial branch as well, in some, and the deterioration of everything, our food systems, healthcare, education, I mean, you name it, everything is worse, you know, by almost any metric. If you're willing to, now, you know, you torture the data, you can get it to say whatever you want. I'm sure, you know, they can paint a rosy picture of how things are in education or whatever. But we all know, like, just open your eyes. There's a reason I'm homeschooling my daughter, you know. It's not because it's more convenient, I'll tell you that much. So, you know, yeah, I think that's just kind of the wake up call. So, okay. The next topic I wanted to get to with you, and maybe this is a semi decent transition, is you seem to be a Doge skeptic, not the meme coin, the, Department of Government Efficiency or whatever they're calling it, yeah. Elon, Vivek and the gang. Hang on, before I ask you why you're skeptical of any progress they might make, Let's begin with a more fundamental question. Do you think they mean well? Do you think that Elon and Vivek and anyone else associated, like the Thomas Masseys of the world, do you think those guys are sincere in their desire to gut the bureaucracy and fire a bunch of federal employees and, you know, rein in regulations?
Thomas Massey, yes.
Mm-hmm. I lumped a handful of people there together. Yeah.
Yeah. Thomas Massey, yes. Elon and Vivek, no way. They're just, okay. Their past is too checkered. And you get, I don't want to say you get one strike with me. Elon's just a weird dude. and he is one of the largest defense contractors. Somehow he is allowed to shoot, and he puts this on X, to shoot rockets at whenever he wants, wherever he wants. And you can't get FEMA to put in a porta potty in hurricane affected zones, right? Everybody, we talk about regulation all the time. When communications went down, all of a sudden Starlink just shows up. Elon's the only guy that's sitting at the helm in X, as we watch the government start to enact legislation next year that's going to make TikTok illegal. So, no, I look at Elon as a like Dr. Evil, you know,
so really not a fan.
I can't stand him. Don't trust him as far as I could throw him. And that's just from what I, and you know what, if I'm proven wrong, prove me wrong. So that he, along with his other oligarch, Vivek Ramaswamy, who worked for the pharmaceutical industry during the COVID pandemic. And he just, I don't know if you follow Anomaly on X, just got body slammed by him, had no words. So this guy, and then the other thing is, look, I'm a petty person as well. And I spent 22 years in the army, right? So when I see the slick talking class valedictorian, you know, posting self-promoting things on X, it just doesn't do anything for my psyche. And do I think these people coming in, I understand I'm a small government guy, but if you think that I'm going to buy into some unconstitutional or extra constitutional organization to come in and make government more efficient, I don't want government more efficient. I want it less efficient. I don't want it more efficient tracking me down. They also said, and this is something that Elon expressed on X, that he does this old trick in American politics. Remember, I'm 60. I've seen this stuff before, right? Oh, the department of this, they invested $40 million in transgender study, all this stuff. We need to get rid of that. And he wrote, so that we can put money into real requirements like defense, Medicare, and Social Security. Well, if you're not going to touch that stuff,
We're not going to get anywhere.
You're not going to get. Yeah. And that's the whole thing. Unless you, I'm 60, right? I paid into the system what I'll probably get into the system. You, Michelle Weekly, you guys know. You're not going to get out of the system what you put into it. You're paying for me. And so until that system is fixed, and then Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, what do you get out of that stuff? Would I rather have that income when I had it before, as disposable income to be able to invest in Bitcoin and make my own investment decisions? Yes, I would. But the government decides I'm not responsible enough, so that they need to take some of my funds and put it aside and invest it, so that someday when I'm old, they can give me the money back so I can live into the future. And in the meantime, they spent all the money. And that is a Ponzi scheme. So anybody who's going to come in, I have no faith in any of these. And that's where I disagree a lot of, you know, with Matteo Pellegrini. I agree with 99% of what he said. I'm not buying it on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Any of these guys. I think if you're really somebody who believes in liberty, you don't get behind the person, because like you mentioned before, right? This may have been off air, how we look at Trump and how we approach Trump, right? He's better. I agree with you. I think most libertarians, most free-minded people agree. He's better than Kamala. But has there ever been a worse political candidate in American history? I American history goes back pretty far, but
not in my lifetime.
I'm not a deep state conspiracy guy, but look, something tells me that the deep state did an evaluation. They're like, we might be better off with Trump. So is he going to be favorable for us? Is Trump's a lifelong Democrat. Depending on how you feel about life, liberty, or whatever, he's pro-abortion. So, you know, he has been his whole life. He didn't address the immigration problem. Yes, he was stultified by Congress last time, but didn't really accomplish anything. He still champions the vaccine, right? Trump has enormous problems. He like comic Dave Smith always says, the thing about Trump is he just doesn't read. He may be a good businessman, but then again, he's had his business problems. He gets hundreds of millions of dollars in political donations from the donor class to say a lot of the things that he says. Highly flawed candidate. All that being said, he's going to be the president, and he's better than Kamala was. And he's certainly better, like Joe Biden. You can get in. I don't want to get into the whole politics thing, but.
You're good.
I know the way I looked at Joe Biden, being a 60-year-old guy, right? Joe Biden was never popular in the United States. He was one of the most reviled politicians, right? Oh, you can say whatever you want about on the political spectrum, whether people liked Obama and didn't like Obama. In those days, I was a hardcore conservative, so I did not like Barack Obama. I like him even less now, but I can understand the appeal where he was smart, well-spoken. He was a great communicator in public. A lot of people wanted to vote for him because they wanted to be able to say that they voted for the first black president. So I at least understand the appeal. And Joe Biden was brought in to kind of prop up the gaps. But Joe Biden, I don't know when it was, 1988 election when he ran, and he got he didn't even make it to the very far in the process, because he was accused of plagiarizing a speech from a member of parliament, Neil Kinnock. And that was a very famous affair where he just changed some words around and directly plagiarized the speech, which is building up his humble roots. And so Joe Biden has always been known to be corrupt and to be a not nationally beloved figure. And so that he is the one that got that bumped out Trump. And I liked Trump, you know, probably up until the whole vaccine stuff went down. I liked him a lot better. And look, I liked what Trump represented, and I still do in a way. He represents what we want him to be, right? He represents it. What we want is an iconoclast to come into government and to say, I hate the government. I hate what you guys have been doing. And I'm going to come in here and start kicking ass and firing people. That's what people thought Trump was. That's not what Trump proved to be. And that's not what he is today. I wish he were. And the first thing he would do is kick Elon and Vivek out of his office and say, I don't need you. Because I don't need government to be efficient. The Department of Defense hasn't passed a budget audit ever, and I want heads to roll. So I want you get the generals in my office right now. I want you in PT uniform, not with all your freaking, you know, what do you get all those medals for anyway? I don't know. Did these guys like jump on a grenade somewhere? These guys are politicians. They're be medaled out the ass. They've kissed more ass to get rank. You come in your PT uniform, and I'm going to smoke your ass and have you do push-ups and burpees, and I'm going to have you puking on the floor until you can answer these questions about where all the money has gone. And then I'm firing your ass. It doesn't matter how well you do. That's what people probably want. That's what I would do. But they're not going to get that with Trump.
That is what you and I want, certainly. That is what sort of back to my like the great awakening that needs to happen. Like that just wouldn't even cross, especially as two former, you know, diehard conservatives, I guess. And most of the people in my life tend to lean that way. I don't hang out with a lot of wokies. Not usually my cup of tea, but, there's like a reverence for, and I have an uncle who's former law enforcement. My wife's cousin served in Iraq, you know, like good people doing what they believe to, you know, is the right thing. And like in putting their lives on the line for something that they believed in. But I think there are a lot of people who sort of just stick their head in the sand on these topics. Like if it's the US military, it must be a good thing because I know someone who fought, or, you know, it's like, I think the US military is probably mostly comprised of good people who mean well. And I mean, at least most of the ones I've met have. But until more people wake up to, you have to stop evaluating like at the individual level and start looking at the results. Like, well, where are we today? And we have 800 military bases around the world and conflicts all over the place. And we're pouring money into parts of the world where we have relatively little economic interest, or at least in many cases. Meanwhile, not that I think that pretend money should go to, you know, any particular group, but meanwhile, things are deteriorating. And if we weren't dumping money in there, maybe we could dump it into something, like it would be better to dump it into something more productive than killing people. So I think we need a great awakening of the masses and more people to desire that outcome that you just described, that heads need to roll. I don't think enough people do yet. And maybe we just need to experience some more pain. We're probably still too comfortable, to your earlier point.
Yeah. And I'm not, look, I'm a flawed, I'm more flawed than most. So I am not preaching here from And again, you know, here's a caveat, right? Just like what you said, right? There's the caveat. And I think we talked about this the last time. I don't believe in this thing called a Bitcoin community. Like when I hear, I know we use the term normies, but there are normies everywhere in every community, right? When I was in the military, our term for normies was basically civilians, right? So you'd be like, oh, civilian, he's a civilian. You know, civilians think this, civilians think that. Well, there are all sorts of different civilians and there are all sorts of different military. And there's at some point we're going to realize there's all sorts of different Bitcoiners. And so I've always looked at it like I am critical of the military because I think it's my role to be so, because I spent so much time in it. And there is a saying, look, and there's a part of me that really loves the army, right? The army did me right. I do not regret my decision to go in the United States Army. And you know, so there's a saying that I didn't betray the army. The army betrayed me, right? The army betrayed my values. And so I work with a lot of great people. I dropped out of high school and I enlisted in the army. And the army was the only institution that I ever joined that I didn't see any prejudice, right? None. And it was merit-based. All the guys that were in charge of the army when I came in were the Vietnam guys. Of course, I disagree with the Vietnam War, but these guys were gods to me. And I would never talk ill of them. My one of my heroes is Roy P. Benavides, who won, you can look him up on Google, won a, and we may have mentioned him last time, won a Medal of Honor in Vietnam for the sacrifices that he made. So I'm not besmirching them or the memory of any people who wore the uniform. And these people, complete strangers, even if it wasn't for some colonels and lieutenant colonels, when I was a private first class taking a personal interest in me, I never would have got into officer candidate school. And they saw something in me and I went to officer candidate school, which was probably one of the best collections of human beings that I've ever been around. There were a lot of special forces people in there, a lot of Delta Force folks in there, a lot of warrant officers, and just what I consider just the badass soldier. But the institution itself is calcified. And that's why a lot of people end up going special forces, especially in the army, because you don't want to be in the conventional force, which thinks conventionally. So a lot of my friends were in SF, and I was going down that road. It's happened to be around the time that my eyes started opening up and I started questioning, why is it that we're doing this thing that we're doing? In my time, and that would have been around the time that I was a captain, this would have been like 1994 or so, I was an artillery officer. I went to the infantry advanced course. And I was going special forces at the time. I went to special forces assessment and selection, got hurt, went to the infantry course to finish. Then SF asked me what did I want to do. They allowed me. I didn't have a college degree because I dropped out of college. And in the Army, you can enlist in the Army. You can go to officer candidate school. You'll get commissioned as a second lieutenant. You don't need a bachelor's degree until you're considered for major. So, I was a captain. The Army let me go back to school to Auburn University as an undergraduate, use GI Bill, and Special Forces was like, we don't care. You know, you just go there because when you come back, you're going to be going to school after school after school. I don't want to say that was a mistake, but once I returned to college in my, you know, early 30s or so, knowing what I knew then, when I graduated college, I was like, I'm going to do my limited time in the Army and finish it out. And so then I went back to field artillery and went to Korea. So I entered the Army as a private first class because I had college, no degree. And I left the Army as a lieutenant colonel with a master's degree. And I lived all over the world. So I think it's a different Army now. It's a different political situation. The lines were a little bit more clearly drawn back then. But knowing what I know now, I would not want that for my children. But for me, I couldn't have designed it any better. And the reason why I complain about it is because I had such a pure view of it. Anybody who's had a good experience in the military and truly loves it doesn't want to see negative things happen to the institution. And nothing more negative happens to the institution than when soldiers die for no reason. And so there is a way, like I said before, I believe in smaller, limited government. There is a way to have close all the overseas bases. This is what many of the founders, George Washington, many of the founders talked about, no entangling relationships. And for people who want to pursue that more, like we talked about off air, Michael Bolden, Path to Liberty podcast, who runs the 10th Amendment Center, he talks a lot about these issues. And even really standing armies hadn't existed since 17th century Europe because they're just very difficult to afford. But once empires started to build, then they had the resources to have standing armies. And then what did you have from the mid 1700s on? These massive conflagrations. And so the United States has gotten itself into this web of alliances now that it's committed to. But there is a way to have a very small armed forces committed to the defense of the United States itself. And where you have a connection, I still believe in a voluntary force. And people could say, well, you can't have a voluntary force. You eventually have to go to conscription. If we have a war, we are bound by treaty to defend Japan. We are bound by treaty to defend the Republic of Korea. We are bound by treaty to defend NATO countries, right? All under, usually under Article 5 of those treaties. That means we're probably not going to have the numbers to do that, and we're going to have conscription. And who voted on that, right? And so you're going to you make people go into the selective service pot, and then the government is deciding which hellhole you're going to go fight in. Whereas if we look at it as Bitcoiners do, right, and you talked about before about more of a cypherpunk and keeping in mind the ideals of Bitcoin, I believe in a well-armed citizenry. I believe in a well-armed militia. I believe that citizens should train in the military arts so that they understand that they're the ones that are responsible for their own defense. Or they can certainly form militias, right? At the state level, you can have national guards at the state level. We can have agreements amongst the states as to who's going to do what, and that may be for a different to go more in depth later on. But the issue is, China's not coming to attack the United States unprovoked. Russia's not coming to attack the United States unprovoked. We have two oceans, guarding us. We have friendly relations with Canada and Mexico. The differences we have with Mexico over immigration can be worked out, and we need to get to the bargaining table and start talking to those people that we think are our adversaries. The way our leaders did during the Cold War, like Richard Nixon going and meeting with Mao Zedong, one of the the most prolific butcher who's ever lived on planet Earth, killing, I think it's 60 million Chinese, right? We were allies with the Soviet Union, and Roosevelt met with Joseph Stalin, right? When we knew the terror that Stalin inflicted on his own people. And so we can certainly stand to sit down and have discussions and then pull our troops out of Europe. You think the Europeans are appreciative of the efforts that we've taken to protect Europe since the end of World War II? Some are. Most aren't, and we shouldn't be bearing that burden and that cost. So I just kind of want to make it clear that I have no hatred for the institution, and I don't disrespect the people who serve and are trying to do the right thing. And that goes for law enforcement as well. But also within law enforcement, a state-sponsored police organization, I am not a big fan of, right? But the function of policing in a civilized society is important. And that's a responsibility that all of us should be willing to participate in voluntarily. Community watches, neighborhood watches, we're all armed. And that the same thing, like you said, it goes for education as well. What I learned in the Army is that And this is kind of probably something that I first saw written down in David Hackworth's About Face. Very good book. He was a colonel, and I don't know if you've read the book, but he was a colonel in Vietnam, and really a shining star in the United States Army, a combat veteran. He joined the Army right after World War II. He was in the Korean War. He was in Vietnam. He earned every medal that he got. And but he was an iconoclast. And he criticized the Army, and basically they ran him out because he said, and he wasn't as anti-war as I am. He basically said on a, I think it was a CBS interview, that the United States couldn't win the Vietnam War if it kept conducting it the way that it was going. And he laid out kind of the way that that the military should operate, right? That it should be only engaged in conflicts where you're willing to put 100% of your resources into the effort, but that's tied to a citizenry that understands, like, and it's getting to your point, Michael, that was, it's kind of like, what's the bang for the buck? What's the ROE? If you understand that it's your responsibility to walk the Ville patrol, the village patrol today, it's just your turn. And you've got to walk around the block, and you have your whatever, your weapons and your comm gear and all that stuff. And that's what you've got to do in your neighborhood. You're probably going to do a better job on it than somebody who's disinterested and from somewhere else. And so what Hackworth talked about in his book is this idea of inspecting everything, checking everything, right? Making sure your weapons are clean, making sure your canteens are full. Make it that you don't leave any detail uncovered, right? That you don't allow your men to shave when you're going on patrol, because the Viet Cong, who are living in the woods, can smell you from a mile away. That you eat the diet of the Viet Cong when you go into the jungle. Why? Because people excrete food through their pores and you can smell them, right? I lived in Korea. Everybody eats kimchi. Until I started eating kimchi, many Koreans have a different smell because that garlicky kimchi is in the system. Once you start adopting to that, your system changes. And that happens anywhere. Like if you come home and your wife's grilled fish or something and you smell fit or whatever, it's when you're out in combat, when you're out in the woods where you're very sensitive to things, you have to adapt to what the enemy does. And so Hackworth talked about checking on everything, leaving no stone unturned. And unfortunately, when you have a big conscripted army that doesn't care about whether they die or not, and they're overseas fighting for something that they don't believe in, then you get 60,000 kids coming back in body bags. But like I said, I don't disrespect those people. I disrespect the system that sent them there. And I, again, it's a little bit of an aside, but.
Yeah, no. I think you and I probably would both agree. Like, this is, I'm painting this with a broad brush, but within these organizations, you have sort of the doers, the workers, I think the people we'd probably mutually respect. And then you have the politicians who happened to some of the generals you talked about. They basically, you know, politicked their way up the ranks and, you know, are kind of detached from any of the goodness that the rest of the group thinks that they're, you know, seeking to promote. So, I think that was it's interesting. So let's totally shift topics here, because we had a lot more bullet points, and we're already approaching an hour and a half. Just talk to you all day. So again, this has nothing to do with anything we've discussed. You mentioned white pilled versus black pilled, and you said it's something that only young people, those are terms only young people use. Is that just because we're so hip, or is that a millennial critique or a Gen Z critique, or what's your
I think you know by now, I'm the type of person that I'll find something to critique and argue about, even if everything's going well. and I think
you hide it so well, Dan.
Yeah, don't I? And it's funny though, I'm completely the opposite with my kids. I have patience with them to just, the older I get, the more patience I have to just let them, you know, roam and kind of feel out things.
But, well, I'm not your son, so lay into me.
Yeah,
tell me what you think.
No, I think it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me, right? And it's almost like the normie term. I'm not going to have an embolism because somebody called somebody a normie. It's that I really want to think through the language that we're using. And so somebody mentioned, it might have been Michael Bolden who I referred to before, the Path to Liberty podcast. When he reads aloud the way the founders used to communicate with each other, when you read these letters, like if you read the Declaration, no one can write that today. It's the level of comprehension.
And so I
don't know if I don't want to belie my lack of or rather contradict my faith in the public school system. I think the public school system has always been bad, and I just basically go off of John Taylor Gatto's books, and I've got several of them. Weapons of Mass Instruction. I think you and I may have mentioned this before when we talked about you beginning the journey of homeschooling.
Is that who, have you heard, you know, Daniel Prince?
That's exactly who he's referring
to.
Yeah,
I was going to say, yeah, I think he talks a lot about it.
He does, and he had a great podcast with Walker on the Bitcoin show. Have you had Daniel on?
I did, yeah. It's been several months.
I'm going to go back and look at it then. I really like
it. Oh, he's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's super. And that's what I'm talking about. When I think of things like that's, and when I say like there's no community or whatever, there, look, I could have you over for dinner. I could have Tony over for dinner. I could have Daniel over, you know, all these folks, Mateo, you know, and we're just going to mesh. And like I said before, if you're like, oh, hey, I got to take my wife to the hospital, can you watch the kids? You don't have to worry. Or, you know, hey, my wife will watch the kids. I'll drive you to the, you know, that's the way that voluntary system, there's discrimination there because we've already vetted each other so that we have an idea, right? I consider you a friend and I've talked to you two times over this platform and once in a while we'll communicate through Telegram, but I'm probably closer to you than I may be to other people that have been in to, you know, years of my life because we're having conversations openly, publicly sharing it over ideas that we probably would never have with other folks. So, and when I think about Daniel in particular, and I think of the language that he uses and his daughter, is it Ella, I think, or no, I forget.
Oh, she. I think Daniel's daughter is Laura, Lauren?
Yeah, I think, yeah, maybe? Laura, Lauren. Yeah, yeah, Lauren. Yeah. Yeah, and so that exchange to me is, especially since we homeschool, that is, you know, that's precious. And that also shows me that Daniel is taking the time to invest in his children. And so I doubt they'll be the type of kids that, and again, I understand when we talk about white-pilled or black-pilled, but I'm more comfortable with terms like, well, you know, I'm more positive. I have a more positive outlook, or I have a more negative outlook. Or whatever words that we used to use, which are a lot. The English language, I think, has the largest vocabulary by far from any other language in the world. And it's a gift. I will say it's a gift from God, but it is a gift that it's the language that we exchange ideas in, because like a guy like Mateo is expected to speak English, whereas it would be surprise the hell out of him if we were fluent in Italian. Right. And that's because of the size and scope of the United States. In the Netherlands, and I spent a lot of my friends are Dutch. Many of them speak 3, 4, 5 languages. The same in Denmark, because their populations are so small, and they have to be able to speak with their invaders. So they all have to know French, and they all have to know German. German's a good one to know when it comes to invasions. And so it's just, and I can flow with the red pill and the blue pill and the orange pill, and I got it. And so I would never, especially the Orange Pill app, when you look at it like something like that, that's very clear and it's uniquely used. You get Orange Pill app, you instantly know it's about Bitcoin. So in this there's a time and a place. And I think amongst Bitcoiners, it's very appropriate to say, when were you orange pilled? But I just get a little frustrated when people are constricted by their use of language, maybe too much, by using simplistic terms of, I was red pilled. I would rather them. Now, of course, most podcasters aren't going to spend, over an hour and a half talking with somebody over esoteric things like the usage of words. But it kind of really gets to this idea of what's expected of us in as people who are or espouse to be thought leaders in some sort of space, if that's what we think that we are, right? You influence people. Your Tony influences people. The Bitcoin way influences people. In this free market builds out. And I've had interactions with Walker over X, and I was on Bitcoin for Millennials. Why? Because we're able to communicate in this milieu, but we should be able to have the tools to be as specific as we can about what we believe in. You don't have a problem with it. The format of this show is long format. You take the lid off of every topic and explore it. But I think it's in other more constricted environments where people just get a lot more lazy with the language and they don't take the time to unpack things, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's, it's like shorthand. I understand why, in the interest of time, you might just broadly use terms like that. But I think, you miss a lot of the nuance. And it's probably something I need to be more aware of, because there are probably times where, I'll throw out normie, for example. And to your point, there are a lot of different normies. Just in the best reminder of that is your point earlier, that there are a lot of different Bitcoiners. And I mean, the cypherpunks are very different than the ETF bros right now, right? Like, if they're both Bitcoiners, right? They get Bitcoin, or they think Bitcoin's, going to make them rich or whatever. But like, that's about where their commonality ends. Okay. So speaking of bros, you also mentioned in your notes, Bitcoin bros and podcast bros. I don't know if this was a dichotomy you were referencing, or you were lumping those people together. Do I fall into any of those categories?
No,
both categories.
No. You guys are the antithesis of it. And it's funny, because the other day I was listening to one show with the three of you. It was Bitcoin Banter. And Tony was just on a riff. And I was like, God, thank God for these guys. Because and I'm like, if he can speak like that on the podcast, I am. And he just gets so intense. No. And I think that's also based on what he brings to the discussion. You are not any way, shape or form who I'm referring to. I think those folks know who they are. I wouldn't put Daniel Prince on that list. I wouldn't put Michelle Weekly or Daniel Prince or any of the people that I reference, like the Simply Bitcoin guys. Sometimes they get under my skin and I'll fire off something to them. But they're all four who are public, I think, are genuine and want to find out as much about and expose people as much as they can about this information. And in fact, I went back and forth one time with Rustin, did this really a couple weeks ago. I love his videos, and he did a really emotional one, and he was breaking down, and I wrote him a note and I said, it's important to show your emotions. Don't ever apologize for that. That shows that you're real. And he, we went back and forth with, bro hugs on X. So no, I'm more referring to people that kind of should know better, more in the libertarian space. And they're the ones that I operate on the premise that, look, there are very few heroes. I don't believe that I've met any heroes in my life. There's a lot of people that I've admired, especially in the army. But a hero to me is somebody like a doctor that goes and volunteers to go in a combat zone and is stitching together kids and holding back the tears because they're imagining it's their own child. That's a hero to me. That's a different level. A hero is, yeah, a Marine that jumps on a grenade to save your life. That's rarefied air. And none of the pod, I like to listen to a lot of different podcasts, but, and this goes back to what we talked about with Tulsi and all these personalities. At some point, if you listen enough to them, you realize there's really like this clique that's going on, and that certain podcasters, they won't criticize other podcasters who they might disagree with because that other podcaster has a bigger audience and they get on that platform, or they won't criticize people like Tulsi Gabbard. They won't look at her record. They want to think, again, it's like with Trump. They want to think that this public figure is something who she really isn't. And if you just scratch the surface, you're going to find that there are some challenging things. And this comes from, again, I am shaped by my military experience. So when I was in graduate school, my thesis ended up being, I went to Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. My thesis was U.S. This is right after 9/11. I got there during right after the day of the attacks. And my thesis became U.S.-China relations in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, because what started to form was this hive mentality that somehow Russia and China and everybody are going to be friends. And if we remember, and then Scott Horton writes about this in Provoked as well, is Francis Fukuyama. A lot of these neocons were writing articles when the Soviet Union fell that this was the end of history, that now you're just going to have liberal democracies and you're not going to have a war anymore. And this was written in the 1990s. And then we went through the whole Balkan Wars, Somalia, Haiti, you know, places that, you know, Iraq War One, all these things that I teach to my son that I witnessed firsthand, some firsthand, some through others. I had friends that were deployed to all these places. Man, I went down a rabbit hole.
I was just listening. We're talking about the Bitcoin Bros podcast.
Yeah. There are folks that are involved in these types of historical moments and they have an outlook, a picture of life that develops. Right. And so my experience at grad school was, my thesis advisor, now I'm back with you, was a CIA analyst, a China expert, fluent in Mandarin. He was fluent in Japanese as well. He had lived in Taiwan. He had lived in China. And I took 5 courses with him, and he was my thesis advisor. And every class that I had with him, he used to draw this kind of grid. And so you could go into him and you could say something. And I'm not a big fan of the CIA, but a lot of the people who are analysts are pretty smart folks. And the best of them don't take anything at face value. Go figure. And so if you went in there and said, hey, I think China is getting more liberal. And then he'd go, okay, well, where'd you get that from? Well, I read it in the South China Morning Post this morning. Okay. Do you read it in English? Yeah. Okay. Well, who wrote it? This guy. Well, who is that guy? Well, that guy is it. Well, who is that guy married to? What is his political philosophy? Who pays his paycheck? What does he eat in the morning? I mean, you're getting grilled, all this stuff. Where did he work for before? Right. And so and this person's writing in the South China Morning Post. What does he know about the military leadership of the People's Republic of China and the Central Military Commission? And what does he know about the Central Military Commission's hierarchy within the People's Committee, the Central Committee? So then you would go through this exercise of, you draw the grid out there and you'd say, okay, well, this general is replacing this general, and this politician is replacing this politician. And you're going to take 2 bios and you're going to do a deep analysis of each of these people, and you're going to compare them, and you're going to try to draw for me a trajectory of Chinese foreign policy and describe it in a way that isn't like more liberal, because more liberal in China really means more conservative, right? So meaning as they move to the left of the communist scale, right, you become more of a conservative where you're trying to conserve the way of thought, of the people's thought that's influenced by, and I think Jiang Zemin was the head of the PRC at the time. So all your papers are, and then he would always say, when you do this type of analysis, we had like one midterm, it was a 5-page paper, and one final, it was a 10-page paper. He doesn't want 5.5. He doesn't want 9.25. He wants 10. And it's not font magic, because what he's trying to do is produce the ability to present information in a digestible form, the type that you're going to have to hand in as an analyst to a superior officer so that you can walk them through this process so they can make better decisions. So with having that kind of view of life and graduating from that, you know, that intellectual process doesn't, I'm not saying makes me any smarter or any better, but it made me look at everything the same way. So when I see a story on Tulsi, or I see a story on RFK Jr., or I see a story on, of course I can go directly and lose faith in all these people no matter what. And I do. It's inevitable, because I'm going to ask all those questions. I want to follow the money. I want to follow where they came from. What are their policies? What do they believe in an abortion? What do they believe in the role of government and all those things? And when I do that analysis, then I come to a determination that virtually no one in the Trump administration is a serious alternative to the big deep state government that we have right now. And so when I refer to the podcast bros and the you know, Bitcoin bros, these are people that don't do that type of analysis, and they go on X or whatever, and they're like, this is going to be great. Elon and Vivek are going to really clean things up. How so? And if they do, great. But if you haven't done the analysis on everything, when you go through X, I don't care who you are. Elon posted this thing where he's standing there like Santa, and he's like in this pose in front of a Christmas tree with these X lights going across, right? And he looks pretty thin, and he wrote Ozempic Santa, right? And sends this meme out. I'm 60 years old, man. What does that mean? Are you for Ozempic? Are you against? What is that? Who does that? So if this is an, okay, lighten up, Darren. It's just a meme. It's just, relax, bro. I'm not relaxed, because this is the guy that you're going to bring in an unconstitutional means to make government more efficient. If you're that guy, I don't want you doing that. In fact, I don't want you posting at all. I want you in a suit, and I want you putting forth serious information, not, hey, what was it? The once we colonize Mars, you know, dot, dot, dot. I don't want to colonize Mars. Go live in the desert. If you know, there's all these shit. They posted this shot of Mars, and it looks like the friggin' desert. I spent 5 months living in the desert in the first Gulf War. That's a harsh environment. But I can breathe the air. It doesn't cost trillions of dollars to put me in the space to get me there. And I can go live there on a whim if I want, but I don't. I don't know if you remember Sam Kinison, right? The comedian. He used to, you know, I'm sure find it on YouTube. You know, he used to make a joke of we would see all these promotions for like Save the Children or something, because there were starving people in Ethiopia. And he's like, of course you're starving in Ethiopia, because there's nothing there but sand. Move, you know. And so in his own way. So that's what I'm referring to when I say the and the podcast bros are the people that look at that and they think Elon is giving us free speech. This is so great. Have we gotten to the point, right, where, and Jonathan Turley, I think he's at Georgetown University. He's a legal scholar and professor. You've seen him. He used to be on Network News all the time, wrote a fantastic book. I think it's called The Free Speech. I think it's The Essential Right in the Time of Rage. And you can also watch him give that publicly. He may have given a public address at the Ron Paul Institute. And he talks about that being the essential right. Right. And how it can't be infringed whatsoever. and that people should be able to say whatever they say. So this is a natural right, and this is what John Locke said. This is what the founders believe. They wrote the Bill of Rights to help protect it. But don't ever say that I have a First Amendment right to speak. That's not true. Or I have a Second Amendment right to bear arms and be in a militia. No, that's your God-given right. You were born with that right. A person born in the Netherlands or in Ethiopia or in Egypt, they were born with that right. We just happen to have a system that the anti-federalists insisted on putting in this codification because they knew most of the federalists didn't want Americans to have this power. So how did we go from a nation of people that believed that they had these natural rights and that we fought wars over them to thank God for Elon, because if it wasn't for him on X, we wouldn't have free speech? That's a pretty precarious place to be if that's what you believe. And it's not looking like when we see what happened with Facebook, when we see what's happening with the ban on TikTok, I don't care. And I heard there's on the Libertarian Institute with hosted by Keith Knight. He had a discussion with a lawyer who is fighting against the government's new legislation that it's going to enact next year. I think it goes into effect on January 19th to basically ban TikTok. And it leaves the door open to banning any type of platform that conducts itself in a manner that doesn't comport with government expectations, right? That's right up there with alien and sedition laws that we've had. That's right up there with punishing political speech or what was done to Julian Assange. So if what we're saying is that we live in an era that we just don't take these rights to be as important as the air we breathe, but then we're now reliant on Elon to provide it through X, or that Elon and Vivek, right? And then there's the connections with JD Vance, that these guys are going to come in, and these three dudes out of 350 million people, they're going to go in and square it all away. They'll fix it. Not the people that are there now, not the generals that are in charge of DOD, not the folks that are in charge of any of these other bureaucracies. Nope. Hold your breath, America, because these three people are going to come in and fix everything. And then when you have Tulsi come in as the director of national intelligence, well, now we're going to get to the bottom of things. I'm just not buying it.
I think that's a very, very fair position to take. And as a total aside, I completely agree with you. I could not possibly care less about colonizing Mars. I don't know why that's such a strong desire. I think that's a psyop. I think like Elon thinks it's cool. I think he's, there's a lot of money to be made with military contracts based on the technology he produces, and I think he's probably genuine that he wants to colonize Mars, or he thinks like he's an ambitious guy. I'll credit him that. Couldn't care less. I don't think it makes any sense to me. I don't think it's going to happen for quite some time. But okay, so I think we should save one topic for another discussion, because just in the interest of time, I want to talk more about the founding fathers, the founding documents, how we went from liberty to whatever we were tolerating today. But I think that's another conversation, because we could probably go a long, long time on that. I know you've got many thoughts, yeah, and a lot of rabbit holes, I suspect.
I get the declaration right here, baby. Constitution. Let's go. Yeah, we'll do another one on that.
I've got it sitting next to my bedside table.
Good stuff.
So one of the things you mentioned in the slides that you sent me was, like people talk about the "then they fight you" stage. And you made an astute point that if you don't fight back, you will lose. Like it's not like it's just something you got to kind of skip through prior to winning. Like you have to fight the fight in order to win. Maybe the first question is, do you think that we are entering a "then they fight you" stage? Because so hang on, let me step back. There seems to be a lot of hope in the Bitcoin space, the Bitcoin community, as you like to call it. I'm kidding.
Yeah, my favorite.
No, but you know, amongst people who promote Bitcoin, like Bitcoin, own Bitcoin, that you know, we kind of made it through Operation Choke Point 2.0. Yeah. Sorry, it's getting late here for me. You're good. And with a more friendly administration coming in, talks of a reserve, talks of, you know, the ETFs, like Wall Street's here, big money's here. Like maybe we're kind of glossing over this then they fight you stage. My sense is you think there's still a then they fight you stage to come, or maybe we're in the midst of that, and I'll let you, you know, maybe elaborate. But maybe you could talk a little bit about where are we at in this evolution. Do you think we have the fight in us to win, or is your base case that we end up with something less than freedom money?
Yeah, this is going to be something that you and I are going to have to tease out over like 15 episodes. what my inclination is to, because it's very difficult to define terms. Like in military planning, we always have these things like terms of reference, and the terms of reference lay out what the definitions of the terms that you're using. Right. So everything we do in the military, man, you know, I didn't know my life would become so militarized, and then I'm anti-war. But everything that's done in the military at a certain level is done in a 5-paragraph operations order. And I have adopted this mentality so much that I, even if I do civilian things, I'll write an operations order. And so you have situation, enemy, different things like that, logistics, you know, command and control. Command and signal, rather. So you can adapt it to almost any environment, and actually you could do it to probably Bitcoin self custody, where you would have, you know, that's a good idea. I should write an op order, but by hand, not on a computer. See, you guys did teach me something. So in the terms of reference, I don't even know who they are, right? I don't know who the enemy is. So, and this is what, like I said, I don't really believe in this idea of a. Although I'll use the term like the Bitcoin community, I look at it a lot like the Black community or the Jewish community, right? You know, human beings are organized in certain systems and ways, but I think you really, it's a very weak one to do it by race and religion and things that are very hard to nail down. It might be better when you say, you know, carnivores or something. In people who are Bitcoin maxis, whether no matter what side of the fault line that they're on, whether they're on the money go up or the freedom money side, are in somewhat of a unique class because they saw something. I'll accept that, but that doesn't mean that is one. I think we've maybe come to an agreement that there's the money go up people, and right now I'm in that camp because I'm having a hard time seeing. I want it to be freedom money. I want it to build out. But is the war then going to be fought between the number go up people and the freedom money people? Is that where the battle line is drawn, where you have a certain amount of people that have so much Bitcoin and they've been able to influence government, that government is a good thing for them the way it stands now, and a strategic Bitcoin reserve might be a positive thing, and that those are the people, because they know Bitcoin, that we're going to have like a civil war, that they know how to approach shutting down the on-ramps and off-ramps of the freedom money people. So I look at it like it's certainly like an insurgency or a counterinsurgency operations, where there's not just front battle lines where you've got the line of Napoleonic, you know, Russian guys versus the line of Napoleonic French guys, and they line up and they get within 50 yards of each other and they just start blasting away. So it's very hard. I think it's going to be a lot more messy in a way. Now, again, I'll go ahead and use my second favorite term, white pilling. At the end of the day, and see, I can show that I can adapt. At the end of the day, I am white-pilled, right? I have a positive outlook because I continue to believe in human ingenuity. And I think the smartest people are in our space, whether they are the money go up people, whether they are the freedom money people, or whether they're a combination of both. And I think, to be fair, and I'll be presumptuous in saying that you and Tony and that everybody, we're kind of both, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I want to see money, but the thing is, the money go up thing is, you know, we're going to conclude, you and I are going to look at each other and go, the purchasing power of fiat money is going down. So that just ergo, the value of having a sound money goes up. Now, what we're able to do with that is really defined on how, because I see the ultimate enemy as government, how much we tolerate government interfering in this enterprise. And that's the whole thing. So, and I'll close on this because I know we're going on like 2 hours and I'm retired. I can go all day and it's getting late for you. But I kind of had this thing with like Michelle Weekly. She's trying to get other older people to adopt Bitcoin and doing it in a way that's not like hammering them down with like, no, you need to run a node and self-custody. There may be gradual steps. So my gradual step was Coinbase, Exodus wallet, Trezor, right? And then you maybe migrate to Swan, right? And I'm not going to mention why or what. Everybody who's in the space understands why. And then to the Bitcoin way, right? Because, and this isn't, I don't get paid by the Bitcoin way. It's not a plug. But there's this natural progression where, and this is what I was talking about before, when you get more serious about this thing and you understand, look, the bottom line is Bitcoin is going to be good for most people. Whether you're on the freedom money or the number go upside, it's going to be better. And if you believe in that, it's better that you take self-custody, right? So that's what the Bitcoin way helps you with. But then she also put in the middle, right? There's this other alternative, which is to use a platform like Unchained, right? Where they do multi-sig, right? And you have multi-custodial access to the Bitcoin, which is not as preferred as what you advocated the Bitcoin way. But if you are in a tax situation, like have an IRA, the only way, as far as I know, that you can have any custody of your keys of Bitcoin in an IRA is to go through Unchained. I know there may be some other entities out there. That's, to me, that's less preferable to self-custody and being completely independent, running your own node, having a hardware wallet, checking in with ND every once in a while to make sure you're not screwing it up. That's the gold standard. And then, of course, going into the security offerings that you have, the plan B option, all those things, right? People who have thought that out like you guys, that's why we all think alike, because we know that that's the end state no matter what. But there is this, there are steps that you may have to go through, not because you prefer them, but I can't, if I take delivery of all the IRA Bitcoin and just put it into cold storage, which I could, then you have a reporting issue, right? You've got to report that and that becomes a tax. So that's not a Bitcoin issue. My friends and I uncovered this a long while ago. That's not a Bitcoin issue. That's a government regulation issue.
Yeah. So then it always comes back to government. Yeah. Everything is a government issue.
So we started out this Bitcoin podcast where you were this young, impressionable guy, white pill, believing in everything, right? And then I've converted you into this hardcore as you're falling asleep on the podcast. It's government, damn it. You know, I thought it would take you 25 more years. But,
oh my gosh. No. I believe you hang out with the guys at the Bitcoin Way long enough.
Oh my God.
I'm sure.
Cause I get what you guys say on air.
You can't imagine the before and after.
No,
friend.
I can imagine. I imagine,
you probably can. Yeah. By the way, you should join a Bitcoin banter sometime. That'd be fun. We've had a guest on once or twice.
I'll throw grenades in. But the thing is like, you know, just to finish up on that point,
oh,
yes,
yeah.
I think we are where now they fight you, because I think you are in that stage, no matter what. And it all depends on where you, like, I'm an American, I'm speaking to an American. I want to be very careful to include other people around the globe, Europeans in particular. There, no European is living in a free country, right? In Germany, it's illegal to homeschool. And like Daniel Prince talked about when he was on with Walker, that it's illegal to homeschool in Germany because that's a rule that they kept from the Nazi regime, right? So homeschooling, I think there's like maybe 400 families that homeschool here in Japan or something like that. So when we take our liberties for granted, we are in now they fight you stage, but you were born into that. I was born into the now they fight you stage because we've got the income tax. We have the Federal Reserve. Oh, you pay property tax. That's the government is fighting you constantly. So that Bitcoin developed 15 years ago and has given us this opportunity to get out of that fight. Maybe that's a better way to look at it. And then how do they manage that? I don't think anyone, the early adopters to Bitcoin like Tony could have anticipated. Sure, they could have anticipated that Bitcoin would become what it is, but maybe not as quickly, maybe not as much corporate adoption, maybe not as much FOMO or government adoption. So it's very hard to anticipate what the battle lines will look like. But that goes back to what we started out talking about, is the reason why I'm uncomfortable with the term fix the money, fix the world. It reminds me of like all those Chinese slogans, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, when you drive through Beijing and it's, you know, the People's Party is one and all this stuff. And Mao says, you know, or in Germany, Arbeit macht frei, over the death camps. You can come up with a slogan and it may be appropriate. And I understand what people are trying to say, that the Bitcoin standard is far better than the fiat standard. But man, we have a lot of work to do. And that may require you move to another place. And I don't even think that's an answer, because if you leave standing the system that's seeking to oppress you, that system will come find you. And we know that from what happened, you know, what's happened to a bunch of folks. Was it Roger Ver, you know, who's got a completely different, and I know you guys talked about it, you know, different take on what we think about Bitcoin, but the guy shouldn't be in the situation he's in just because of the thought police think something differently. So yes, we're in the now they fight you stage, and it's going to be the white pill aspect is with Trump coming in, like Michelle Weekly pointed out, and I completely agree with her, I'm not expecting a fundamental change in American society or in the medical or the American political system, but maybe we have somebody that's slightly more friendly or not as aggressive in going against building out what we need to build out. And I think she said that you give us this 4 more years of breathing space and maybe we built something. And I'll use the collective we for the community. That really refers to all the smart people that are in the space, right? That adhere to what Ludwig von Mises called human action. They're proving that a voluntary system can build out, right? No one, the government doesn't give subsidies to somebody to build Cake Wallet or foundation devices to come out with their the hard wallet or the software or the new product that they're the prime. That's happening in the space. Or for you guys to form and to deliver services to a clientele that takes their digital future seriously. So more to follow on this topic for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I got to ask the last question. I think you've mostly just given unpopular opinions for the last 2 hours, but as a formality, I need to ask you what's an unpopular opinion that you have. You're welcome to reiterate, but if you want to piss off some Bitcoiners, that's always bonus points in my book.
No, you know, I spend so much time doing, and I really like, you know, if people go to my ex thing, they're just going to think I'm a psychopath. It's that I just don't think the strategic Bitcoin reserve is a good idea, and yeah. I don't think empowering government with anything any type of resources. And I especially I get this from Europeans as well, is that even Bitcoiners they'll say, well, you need government for something. You need government to build the roads, or you need government for police, or you need, and I'll defer to another European, Hans Hermann Hoppe, who wrote Democracy, the God That Failed, and amongst other things. And I also recommend every year he has in Bodrum, Turkey, the what is the Peace and Freedom, Property and Freedom Society? I'm sorry, I'm getting that wrong. But you can find that on podcasts and listen to lectures in the space. Anything by Hans Hermann Hoppe. Dave Smith loves him. Tom Woods loves him. And he talks about the nature of government and how the best government is the smallest government providing the least amount of services. And I really think there are so many people in Bitcoin that are so smart that they're going to be able to really answer any question. And everything, it's like what you guys do with the Bitcoin Way. It's a boutique service, right? It you have to, and Tony said it the other day on the show, if you're going to have this asset that you think is going to be valued where we think it's going to go, you might want to put a few dollars or a few sats in your case towards making sure that the technological aspect of it is impervious to any sort of external invasion. And
right.
And so I look, personal responsibility in everything you do, whether it's the food you eat. That's what I liked about Mateo, food you eat, lifting weights, jujitsu, you know, taking charge of your own financial future, build that out first. And really, you know, don't have too much faith and trust in government, and really let's think through the strategic Bitcoin reserve thing. That's what I would say.
I think that's good. I pulled up I'm not going to share it, but I'll just, a Bitcoiner I think probably has a lot of followers said he's a 10, but he doesn't believe in the Bitcoin strategic reserve. And then someone else who's another prominent Bitcoiner said, ooh, he's a 2. And I said, or hear me out. He doesn't want the government to have more power. So yeah. That's where I bet I went back and listened to my show with Michelle Weekly. I bet you, so if someone listened to that and then listened to this conversation with you, they'd be like, this guy's just a chameleon. He changes his mind about everything. I feel like I've just been like on a journey. I feel like I'm playing catch up on, like I'm deep, deep, deep down the rabbit hole, but there's always like there are like these lingering cobwebs that you have from your old self that you have to like finish brushing down. You know, like I, you know, sort of go back to old defaults at times. And, you know, as I step back and think about more and have conversations like these, it's always enlightening and is incredibly helpful. So Darren, I hope we never get to meet in person, because I think I'd just move in with you so we could have dinner together every night.
Yeah, that's right. My wife would divorce me. Out. Yeah.
we just sit around and talk about that's this right. stuff for
Mama, where's
weeks
Daddy?
On end.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for sure. We'll do it again.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for the time. Yeah, we have a lot. Hey, we give it every, you know, 5-6 months. There's a lot of new stuff to cover. So we'll make sure to revisit some of these topics we didn't get to.
And like you said, we both change. You're like, you're meeting a new person. And I agree. And by the way, I just listened to the Michelle Weekly episode and it's seamless. So okay. I think you're more self-critical, but we're going through the same journey. I don't have any answers. I'm a 60-year-old, you know, retired army bum.
So. Yeah, I just have vague recollections of being very excited about Trump, and then, you know, as I thought about it, talked with some people, I was like, maybe I'm a little more excited about him than I should be. Like, do I really want to trust a guy who, you know,
that's right,
who wants that around, job?
You record around the election time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've I don't regret my vote, but like, I think my enthusiasm for this, I think is maybe where I'm like, settle down. It's easy to get caught up in all the hype and all the, you know, the promises. And, that's just my old self, sort of trying to sneak in.
No, don't beat up on yourself, because I was going back and forth on Signal with a close friend of mine, who's also in the Bitcoin, they homeschool all that stuff. And they were giving me the vote count. And so they're like, if he only picks up this. And we were both into the Harris win mode. That's a different thing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think I would have been fine with, I mean, almost any breathing organism.
That's a good point.
Yeah. That's so good. Now we're just talking about nothing, but I think what I like about Trump, and this is like a flaw in me, is that he pisses off all of the people who I like the least, like the really, really woke crowd. Like, he just drives them crazy, and like, I find it amusing. So like, if there's no policy benefit to that, you know, at least I get some, you know, kicks out of, you know, the banter that we're going to see over the next
unscripted Trump.
When
somebody will post something where he's like, that stupid bit or whatever, or the Rosie O'Donnell, I love unscripted Trump. The problem is he has to be controlled by this team he's got around him to fit into the system that he's going to go into. So everybody wants him to just, you know, to be. I've seen some of the memes that was it the Dog Brothers, or who are those guys that they do like these amazing videos where they replace they use AI and they'll make like Hillary Clinton and Kim Jong.
Go around. I've seen them.
Sometimes those are amusing. And everybody wants Trump to be the badass and to go in and to give them what for. Hey, you know, he might prove us wrong. Maybe he'll do it. So.
Yeah, I've said many times now, cautious optimism.
That's right.
Yeah, so I'm not getting my hopes up.
Kind of a gray pill. I see.
Yeah, gray pill. Darren, thank you so much for your time, man. Great chat, and we'll catch up again soon.
All right, take care. Sounds good. See ya.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Darren. I know I sure did. I love talking to this guy. He's just one of my favorites. Make sure you go follow him on X. Go check out anything that he is working on. Keep an eye on him because he's got a lot of projects, a lot of irons in the fire. And of course, if you enjoyed the episode, if you enjoy the show, follow the channel, subscribe. Really appreciate if you share it with someone, like, comment. Any sort of engagement is always helpful and much appreciated. You can check out The Bitcoin Way on X. We're at @TheBitcoinWay_. You can follow me there as well, @TheOtherMJordan. Of course, if you need help with Bitcoin, proper self-custody, online privacy, Plan B residency options, all those things, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We would love to help you. And as always, remember, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.